We're in conversation with the Republican Accountability Project. This is a conservative group that condemns party members who have supported former President Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, glad you could be here. So the latest Marquette University Law School poll from April found 62% of Wisconsin Republicans feel low confidence in the accuracy of the 2020 presidential election. Join in on the future of the Republican Party in light of the January 6th insurrection and Trump. 800-642-1234. Gunnar Raymer is political director for the anti-Trump organization called the Republican Accountability Project, launched in the aftermath of the January 6th attack. Gunnar, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been observing these weekly focus groups with voters. What types of voters is your organization talking to?
Well, we talk to a whole range of voters. We talk to, you know, Trump, MAGA, America First voters. We talk to flippers, meaning they voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and then they voted for Joe Biden in 2020. And then we also talk to Democrats, too.
And so what happens in these focus groups? Can you kind of take us inside?
Sure. Our focus groups, they're held on Zoom, which makes it really easy from a travel point of view, because we can just, you know, hop on a Zoom and then we get out of our DC bubble and we talk to a bunch of voters. And then we ask them questions, you know, how do you feel about the 2020 election? How are you viewing, you know, voting in future elections? How do you feel about January 6th and all those sorts of things? And, you know, with the Roe v. Wade getting the news, we talk to them about the issue of abortion. So we're always just trying to get our perspective about what the voters are thinking. And, you know, quantitative research and polling is really good. But the thing about the focus groups is it adds a lot of texture to, you know, how voters think about the issues, which is why we like doing these focus groups so much.
Yes. I mean, you can hear right from someone's mouth anecdotes, something that like a survey might not be able, that nuance a survey might not be able to catch. When you talk with these voters, what are people saying in focus groups about the 2020 election that is, you know, well over a year earlier?
Yes. And I would say that, you know, Wisconsin is a perfect state to observe that in. You know, they're still talking about, you know, doing an audit and auditing the 2020 election results. And, you know, what opened up at the top, about 62% of Wisconsin voters, Republican voters, not trusting the 2020 election. And that is exactly what we are seeing with, you know, MAGA, Trump 2016, Trump 2020 voters. You know, they believe the election was stolen from Donald Trump. Do they really have evidence of it? No, they don't. They don't really think January 6th was a big deal. They think maybe what happened was unfortunate, but they blame Antifa or Black Lives Matter, which obviously is untrue. But I think what it is signaling when we watch these focus groups is that Donald Trump has shifted the party, not just to the right, but to just anything that Donald Trump wants to talk about. And Donald Trump's platform, it's full of conspiracy theories. And yes, immigration comes up in these focus groups, trade comes up in these focus groups, but what they really say is that they like the policies of Donald Trump. And then we push them and we go, okay, but what about Donald Trump's policies do you really like? And all they say is, well, it's an America First agenda or something like that. And I think that it is completely emblematic of, you know, when the 2020 RNC platform came out, they said it was just about supporting Donald Trump. And that's really what we are seeing in these Trump 2016, Trump 2020 focus groups.
Is that consistent? Because you've been doing these focus groups for a while now.
It is consistent. And, you know, there was some pause or hope that in a post Jan 6 world, you know, the Republican Party would turn back to normal, would shun Donald Trump. You know, you had Kevin McCarthy on the House floor, you know, going against Donald Trump, saying he bears responsibility for the attack of Jan 6. You have Mitch McConnell having a strong speech about it. But what we have seen, as, you know, people like Kevin McCarthy have actually done, is a full shift right to Donald Trump and supporting, you know, whatever he says.
Talking with Gunnar Raymer, political director for the organization called the Republican Accountability Project. We're talking about their focus groups, what they have been learning as they look deeper into the Republican Party. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You bring up House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. And before we move on, I just want to ask you about these billboards that your organization bought recently in Kevin McCarthy's district around Bakersfield. This is about the audio recordings that surfaced revealing that McCarthy blamed President Trump for the Capitol riot, which contradicted his earlier claim denying he wanted the president to step down. So what is your approach with these billboards?
We put out those billboards to remind the voters in Kevin McCarthy's district is that in private, Kevin McCarthy took a courageous stance. He took a hard stance against what Donald Trump did leading up to January 6th. But right after that, a few weeks later, he was going to Mar-a-Lago and taking a photo with Donald Trump. And it is, again, it shows exactly what the leadership, what Republican leadership stands for. And it's that it's whatever Donald Trump stands for. And Kevin McCarthy has lied about his stance. And it is just, it is completely disappointing. But at this point, it is also expected of someone like Kevin McCarthy to lie about what he said in private and then how he acted publicly.
It seems, though, as if, you know, by putting these up in his district, that you basically want anyone to get this message, not just people in your party, in the Republican Party.
Sure. We are sending a message that a Republican leader lied about how he thought about Donald Trump, but also recognizing that hypocrisy in the Republican Party, especially among Republican leadership, is typical and at this point is expected.
You mentioned flippers early on, and I just want to go deeper there. People who have flipped their viewpoint or perhaps even moved parties. What are your focus groups revealing there?
So most of these flippers are college-educated suburban voters who cannot stand Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party. It is not a majority of the Republican Party. It's about, well, I look to what happened in Ohio last week. You know, you had all these candidates, including J.D. Vance, Josh Mandel, Mike Gibbons, Jane Timken, all running as the MAGA candidate. J.D. Vance ended up getting Donald Trump's endorsement. Mm-hmm. And Matt Dolin, a state senator there, who was not the MAGA candidate, he's still a rock group conservative. He pulled about 23% of the vote. And that's exactly, you know, the universe of Republican voters who don't like Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party. And we talk to them all the time. And I will say there is a little bit of frustration with the Biden administration, and there is some backsliding among these swing voters to the Republican Party. However, they do not like candidates that are going around, you know, touting Donald Trump's endorsement or saying the election was stolen or downplaying Jan 6 or, you know, promoting COVID-19 vaccine conspiracies. So there is some backsliding among this group of Republican voters, of flippers, as we call them. But I will say candidate quality matters. And if Republicans are going to nominate a bunch of crazy Trump-like stop-the-steal candidates, that they are not appealing candidates for these flippers. What? And Wisconsin is a great state of a great example of that.
Why has the myth of the election being stolen become so entrenched with Republican voters, do you think?
It is, you know, there's a few ways to look at it, but I will say it is just an animating issue among Republican primary voters. You have Donald Trump, who is no longer on Twitter. Maybe he will be back. But, you know, he's doing rallies and all he talks about that the election was rigged. He is propping up candidates that are saying that the election was stolen. It is. And then, you know, internally, we track a lot of right wing shows like Steve Bannon, OAN, Newsmax, and all that. And they are repeatedly going on there, bringing on guests to talk about, you know, how the election was rigged and things like that. And it just there's an environment among Republican primary voters right now where the Stop the Steal platform is an animating issue that makes them enthusiastic about voting.
You can join in as we talk with Gunnar Raymer, the Republican Accountability Project, formed in the wake of the January 6th insurrection, seeking to unseat Republicans who have tried to overturn the election, calling out party members who have promoted conspiracy theories. Join in on where the GOP goes from here, how you feel about the midterm elections, rhetoric on the campaign trail, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Gunnar Raymer here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Trump allies in the Republican Party who are still feeding into the false 2020 election narrative, what that means for the midterms, what that means for our democracy. 800-642-1234 to join in. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here in Wisconsin, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss last month extended Special Counsel Michael Gabelman's investigation into the 2020 election, citing ongoing legal challenges to subpoenas he'd issued. And we're going to look at what that means as we look across the landscape of the Republican Party. Gunnar Raymer, political director of the Republican Accountability Project, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just have a concern that if we just look at this as Donald Trump is the reason for the for what's going on, we're missing how Reagan wed the religious right to politics, and that has become more and more extreme over time. We had in the early 90s, I believe, Newt Gingrich's pamphlet called Language, a Key Mechanism of Control, where parties were given stark language to use when describing Democrat policies versus Republican policies. And then when we had voter, we had fraud, voter fraud, repeated over and over and over. And I think all of these actions have really weakened to undermine people's trust and belief in our system of democracy and politicians in general. And that really paved the way for the likes of someone like Donald Trump to take over a party. And I really hope people will look at that, but it just didn't start with Trump.
Lisa, thank you. Gunnar, Lisa taking the historical perspective here.
Yeah, and I think that it all built up to a certain extent, but Donald Trump is the one that exploited it so much. And again, I'm a registered Republican. Our organization has a bunch of Republicans and conservatives in it, former Republicans too. But from our perspective, what happened after the November 3rd election up until January 6th is that from a democracy standpoint, what led up to it is so bad that, we are putting aside any policy issues we have with the Democratic Party or something like that. I would love to get in a place where I can, debate policy with Democrats. But the thing is right now is that what is going on right now, and it didn't get better post Jan 6, is that there is a movement across the country at all levels of government to install these Donald Trump, MAGA, America First, Stop the Steal candidates, and in particular in places where there's election administration. And that is so concerning for us.
I want your thoughts on the Gabelman inquiry into the 2020 elections and effort to decertify results here. He supported Trump's conspiracy theory of a rigged election. It really echoes a similar partisan audit, of Arizona Republicans commissioned last year. What do you take away from what you see happening in Wisconsin?
Yes, this is another example of Republicans doing something to undermine our democracy. The audit that is going on in Wisconsin continues to sow distrust in our elections. That's what that Marquette University poll shows. But also the thing about that is, as we get into, past the primary in Wisconsin in August and into the general election, who's going to be the gubernatorial candidate for Republicans in Wisconsin? Is it going to be Rebecca Clayfish, who says the election was rigged and, against Donald Trump? Or is it going to be someone like State Assemblyman Timothy Ramson, who is like leading a lot of this odd nonsense? Those types of candidates may actually be helpful for the Democrats and Governor Tony Evers, because, again, our swing voters that decided the election for Joe Biden in 2020 are repelled against those types of candidates.
So you mentioned there Governor Evers in the gubernatorial election. What about U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and the prospects in the Senate here as you look at what Ron Johnson has said in the past about the election?
That's right. And Ron Johnson also says a lot of crazy things about COVID vaccines. And again, Ron Johnson is the type of Republican that our swing voters just do not like. My only concern in Wisconsin is Mandela Barnes is a more progressive candidate than Joe Biden ran as in 2020. And, there might be more backsliding in Wisconsin should Mandela Barnes win the Democratic primary against Ron Johnson.
Sounds like, if you could just find moderation somewhere, that might be something attractive. But is that attractive to voters, or do you find this polarism that just seems to be dividing the country?
I think that, what we saw in 2020 was that Joe Biden won over the swing voters in the swing states by running as a not so crazy candidate against Donald Trump. And the best way in 2022, it is a bad year environmentally for Democrats right now. That being said, and I said this earlier, candidate quality matters. And among these suburban voters, they're college educated, they like candidates that are more moderate. And, the best way to win elections, right now it was in 2020, and it's going to be that way in 2022, is winning over this crucial, significant, but small amount of swing voters. And if Democrats choose to nominate more progressive candidates that, again, might be doing better in a Democratic primary, my concern is that these flippers that we do with focus groups who are very concerned about inflation, are not happy with the Biden administration, are going to be less attracted to these more progressive Democratic candidates.
I wonder, do the staunch opinions you find in the focus groups mirror what you see on Capitol Hill and in campaigns with the extreme party politics from lawmakers? Do you see reflections of those two side by side from lawmakers and voters?
I think when we are talking to Republican primary voters that voted for Trump in 16, voted for Trump in 2020, is that they do carry similar attitudes to the extreme Republican lawmakers. And it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. It's what caused what. And there's also the media environment, which helps, helps that as well. But I will say that, there's a recent study in which it showed that Republican activists no longer viewed holding hardline conservative positions. Now they saw hardline conservative positions as something that Donald Trump represents. And there's been a dramatic shift among these GOP activists that shows that being beholden to Donald Trump is more important than holding traditional hardline conservative issues. Hmm.
Gunnar Raymer with us, political director for the anti-Trump organization called the Republican Accountability Project. You can join in 800-642-1234. Gunnar, you mentioned the media environment. And so if Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter goes through, should former President Trump be allowed back to the platform? What does your organization say there?
Well, I don't know if we have a specific position if he should or should not be allowed, but I will say that Donald Trump already has a very big platform. The thing is, when Donald Trump puts out these statements that aren't on Twitter, he has Liz Harrington put them out on Twitter. So I think people are seeing them already, and it will just contribute to Donald Trump's wholesale takeover of the Republican Party.
When you talk to focus groups about the draft opinion from the Supreme Court overturning abortion protections, what do your focus group participants say there?
I think the interesting thing about this Roe v. Wade decision leak coming out is that it is an excuse for Democratic voters to be enthusiastic about voting. That is the thing that we have seen, especially pre this leak, is that Democratic voters are just not as enthusiastic about voting. That being said, this gives them an excuse to be enthusiastic about voting, and it does put a block of suburban women on the table that was not there before in a year that's been favorable to Republicans with environmentally.
What do you do with all this focus group information, all this data? How do you work through it? How do you look at it?
Well, again, we sit in them a lot, and it helps shape how we think about politics. And just give a shout out to Sarah Longwell, who I think has been on this program before.
She has.
She's the executive director of the Republican Accountability Project. We have the focus group podcast where, some of it's primary specific, some of it is issue specific, but that gives the viewers a sense of what we hear in these focus groups and how we think about politics. So please check that out. It's the Focus Group podcast hosted by Sarah Longwell.
As you look to the midterms, what concerns you most on the campaign trail? What are you hearing from the focus groups in terms of what they're hearing from these people on the campaign trail, politicians?
Yes. Well, there's a lot there. I am concerned with Republican voters thinking the election was stolen from Donald Trump when it was not. From a democracy standpoint, that is terrible. What I am concerned about is this movement of Stop the Steal candidates running for governor, running for secretary of state, you know, in a state like Wisconsin or Arizona. And the idea of these Stop the Steal candidates administering our elections, because they can get through in a year, even though if they are poor candidates, they can get through in a year that is favorable to Republicans. That being said, our swing voters are turned off by these kinds of candidates. And in a year favorable for Republicans, Democrats can sort of luck out as long as these bad candidates make it through their primary.
Gunnar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gunnar Raymer is political director for the organization called the Republican Accountability Project. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the hunt for the state's oldest tree.
The oldest known tree in Wisconsin looks nothing like you'd expect. It's not a huge, majestic tree. In fact, it's so unremarkable that it's easy to miss. WPR's Rob Menser has been looking for this tree for years, and he brings us the story of his search.
This is the story of a hike I took and how, after years of looking, I finally found the oldest tree in Wisconsin. Maybe. Sort of.
So where am I looking?
For this? I think it could be one of those. I guess we don't know.
Okay.
When I imagined Wisconsin's oldest tree, I pictured a massive red oak with limbs the size of telephone poles. But that's not it at all. The oldest tree in Wisconsin, the oldest one we know about anyway, is a scrawny little red cedar that's growing out of the side of a cliff. I got interested in this tree about 4 years ago. I was working for a newspaper at the time, and I interviewed Douglas Larson, the scientist who discovered it in 1997. What he found was that cliffs all over the world support some of the oldest life on Earth. In Wisconsin, on a cliff formation called the Niagara Escarpment, he sampled a cedar tree that was nearly 1,300 years old. But the tree is hard to find. It's on private property in Brown County. I tried to track it down, I talked to people who had seen it, and I wrote that story for the newspaper, but I never did get to see the tree for myself.
I only learned that the tree existed a couple of years ago.
So wait, did you learn about this tree from me?
Yes, kind of. It was your article.
That's Jody Davies. She and her partner Clayton own a cannabis shop in Wrightstown.
And so I was literally asking everyone I knew that would come in, like, have you heard of this tree? Do you know where it is? Is it really here? And nobody knew.
Until one day, one of her customers said, yeah, I know where it is. I can take you out there. In September, Jody sent me a message on Facebook. Hi, Rob, she wrote. I was wondering if you ever found that tree. We're having a small field trip to go see it, and I wondered if you'd like to come along. I tried to play it cool, but yeah, I wanted to come along.
The Niagara Escarpment is actually...
At the Wrightstown Fire Station, a small group of us watched a documentary about the Niagara Escarpment.
I like to think of it as the ancient backbone of North America.
Hundreds of millions of years ago, this was the shoreline of a prehistoric lake. The same cliffs that create Niagara Falls in upstate New York wind through Wisconsin. Dennis Bining, whose house is at the bottom of the ledge, had gotten permission to bring the group of us on a hike to see the tree. The problem was, he told Jody, we couldn't get that close.
We had that tornado come through in 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's going to be tough to get to the base of the ledge, because of the devastation.
The other problem was the cliffs are hundreds of feet high. We got as close as we could to the tree, but it was still pretty far away. Dennis let us look through his binoculars, but if I'm honest, I wasn't 100% sure which tree growing out of the side of the cliff was the tree.
Did you get closer when you did your story?
No.
I didn't get this close,
oh,
no.
Gotcha.
I drove
gotcha.
Down that road.
And that was it. That was as close as we got. On the walk back, we tried to convince ourselves that we'd accomplished the mission.
Very cool.
I mean, we saw it.
We did see it. We aren't sure exactly which one.
But our eyes saw it.
Why can a scrubby little cedar tree growing from the side of a cliff live for 1,300 years? The face of a cliff is a terrible place to grow. It doesn't get good water, it doesn't have rich soil. But here's the secret. When you're growing from a cliff, no one bothers you. Most of the time, people can't even find you. But we did find the tree. We did get to see it. You know, probably.
WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story on Wisconsin's oldest tree. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now, as the U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to return abortion regulation to the states, we look at what reproductive health care access could look like in a post-Roe Wisconsin. Join in on reproductive health, on access to birth control, on how miscarriages are managed. 800-642-1234. Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison. She directs the OBGYN Division of Reproductive and Population Health and leads the UW Center for Reproductive Equity. That's a reproductive healthcare research initiative. Jenny, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I appreciate you paying attention to this really important issue.
What went through your mind when you first read the leaked draft opinion? What stood out to you?
It was a moment that was both expected and stunning. I think the fact that the decision was as stridently worded as it was, leaving open a variety of other sorts of cases to emerge, was really stunning. On the other hand, those of us working in the abortion research field have been anticipating this moment for quite some time. So it's also the culmination of a whole bunch of things leading up to this moment and something we were expecting.
What about the response of the nation, the protests, the demonstrations that you've seen across cities, and what do you make of the reaction to the draft?
I'm not surprised. I think that abortion is an incredibly important litmus test in our country and our political landscape for a variety of things. And I also think that few people may have actually realized how threatened legal abortion was. And I think we've seen glimpses of that with recent bills that were passed in Texas and Oklahoma and Ohio and Mississippi and Louisiana, showing a weakening of abortion access. But I think Roe was really a moment of reckoning for people around it. And I'll say, I think folks also perhaps were out of the loop around how abortion's legality does not equate with accessibility, right? So in places like Wisconsin and all across the country, just because abortion is legal, and even when healthcare clinics exist, there are a number of people who can't access services because of financial constraints, because of distance, because of a variety of other factors.
And I want to probe that a little further, because President Biden last week said this is about a lot more than abortion. Can you explain some of that ripple effect of overturning Roe and ending the constitutional right to an abortion? What are the ramifications there on other things?
It's a great question, and I will talk to you about abortion research all day long. I'm not a policy expert here, so I want to defer to some of my policy colleagues to give you a really in-depth answer around that. But I think that the overturning or the significant weakening of Roe v. Wade, especially the way the decision was worded, leaves open a variety of other issues that we have been considering set in stone, but might not be, right? So we've seen declines in contraceptive services, public funding for contraceptive services over many years, and those declines may be likely to increase, as well as potentially different contraceptive methods in certain states being potentially threatened or prohibited in light of certain abortion bans. So while I'm not exactly sure what will unfold from a policy perspective on those other issues. The direction certainly doesn't look to be in the direction of supporting people's ability to have the families they want to have, feel supported in that, be able to prevent and or prevent pregnancies and or seek abortions as they need and desire.
From the research you do, you found 91% of physicians believe women's health care would worsen if Roe is overturned. How could women's health care worsen without this, the national abortion protections under Roe?
Yeah, it's a great question. And just to lift up that study, our survey was of over 900 doctors at our state's largest medical school and our only public medical school. So these were 900 doctors across medical specialties. And more than 90% said that women's health care in Wisconsin would get worse if Roe v. Wade were overturned. So abortion is often seen as an important outcome by itself. It is an important indicator of reproductive autonomy. However, abortion is also a determinant of health and well-being across the life course. So let me give you a few examples of this. One is we have excellent research showing that compared to people who were able to access desired abortion services, people denied desired abortion services and then who go on to give birth are more likely to stay in abusive relationships. They're less likely to be able to achieve aspirational life goals. They're less likely to complete post-secondary education, more likely to experience persistent adverse economic consequences, right? So we know that there are negative impacts on health and well-being. We also have evidence that abortion restrictions contribute to increased maternal mortality, especially among Black communities and other structurally oppressed communities. And we're strongly anticipating a rise in maternal morbidity and mortality if and when abortion is outlawed or made completely inaccessible in a state like Wisconsin. And some people hear this figure and think, oh, that's because of the potential for unsafe abortions. And that's not it at all. The increase in morbidity and mortality will come about because inherently carrying pregnancies to term and giving birth are more risky than first trimester abortion. So giving birth from an adverse event perspective is 14 times as likely to end in death than a first trimester abortion. So that's another impact on people in Wisconsin if they are not able to access desired abortion services.
We have UW Reproductive Equity Scholar, head of the UW Division of Reproductive and Population Health. Jenny Higgins here stays with us on the ripple effect on reproductive health care if the High Court overturns Roe. Join in on what could be an entirely different landscape for reproductive health, what you see ahead, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jenny Higgins here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. Let's get back to our conversation now at the intersection of reproductive health care. What happens if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade? The Guttmacher Institute, that's the research group focused on reproductive health, it says if Roe falls, 26 states are certain or likely to ban abortions. That includes Wisconsin. Still time to discuss, 800-642-1234. Jenny Higgins is a UW-Madison professor of obstetrics and gynecology, directs its Center for Reproductive Equity, former board of directors, vice chair of the Guttmacher Institute, stays with us. Let's bring in Ron now in Pioneer, Missouri. Ron, hi. What would you like to add?
We need a moderate policy which 80% of the U.S. population, the 80% in the middle, will tolerate, not necessarily like, but tolerate. And so my question is concerning the U.S. population in 2021, before the current controversy, what percent of the population rejected the status quo on abortion? What percent rejected it because they are pro-life? What percent rejected the policies because they're pro-choice? You know, is the current policy in the middle, or is it skewed to life or choice?
Ron, thank you for that question. Jenny, what does the research tell you?
The research tells us that the majority of people in the U.S. do not feel that Roe should be overturned. The majority of U.S. citizens feel as if Roe should be left in place. As researchers, we have sometimes struggled with the questions used in polling around abortion. There's a really robust literature showing that what we think we're capturing when we ask people about their attitudes about abortion aren't actually accurate. When we phrase questions in our research along the lines of, to what extent do you agree that a pregnant person should be able to decide in consultation with her doctor about whether and how to either terminate a pregnancy or carry a pregnancy to term? The overwhelming majority of people agree with that statement. So this Supreme Court decision does not, if it, in fact it overturns Roe, does not represent the majority of Americans' opinions on this issue.
So language, what you're saying, really matters. You also found an overwhelming majority of respondents have concerns about the doctor-patient relationship. What are you finding there?
Yeah, our research suggests that physicians are quite concerned about the ways in which about legislative interference into their practice. And abortion is an interesting and perhaps exceptional example of how people without healthcare training experience are determining the ways in which healthcare services are offered or not. And so I think physicians are quite concerned about that trend, in addition to the consequences of that trend on patients.
You mentioned earlier unsanctioned abortions. What are the risks there, the medical risks?
Sure. So let me first say that when people cannot access abortion in their own states, they'll do one of three things. They will either cross state lines into what we call haven states, where abortion access will be protected regardless of Roe status. But of course, many people will be unable to do so. And we have evidence that many people currently can't get abortion services within their state, even when it's legal, because of a bunch of barriers. A second thing that will happen to people is that they won't be able to get abortions at all and will be forced to carry pregnancies to term. And then the third option is that people will self-manage their abortions. And when self-management means working outside the formal healthcare system without clinical consultation to perform an abortion on oneself. And the options for self-managed abortions are very different now than they were around the time that Roe v. Wade was passed. So there are FDA-approved medications called misoprostol and mifepristone that are currently used for medication abortion care in the U.S. They cause miscarriages to occur. These pills are available through non-standard healthcare centers, mm-hmm. So mail order services, for example. And so we expect that people will turn more and more to these services. We're already seeing evidence that with Texas's six-week ban, the increase in orders to one particular medication abortion service called Aid Access increased. We also know during COVID that orders to Aid Access increased, suggesting that people are already self-managing their abortions due to difficult access.
We're talking with Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison. Jenny, how would a ban on abortions complicate care around miscarriages?
It's a great question. So we certainly, from a research perspective, from a clinical perspective, are expecting more people to show up in emergency rooms or primary healthcare centers with miscarriages in process. Now, care providers cannot discern whether a miscarriage started naturally or was induced through medication. There's just no way for a healthcare provider to tell that. So we are hoping and expecting that we can prepare healthcare providers to be equipped with tools to help with miscarriage management, which often are just needing care around excessive bleeding. So we are really hoping that that happens. We have a number of Catholic-owned healthcare systems in Wisconsin and in many other states. And at Catholic-owned healthcare facilities, something called the ethical and religious directives determine and shape the type of care that can be offered at those facilities. And miscarriage management goes against the directives because it, in some ways, is against God's will or against the natural experience of someone having a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. So we're concerned from a research and clinical perspective that in places in Wisconsin and elsewhere where a Catholic-owned hospital is the only accessible hospital in the county, that folks might get turned away from necessary miscarriage management care.
Or perhaps even the physician, you know, if there is an abortion ban, the physician might be apprehensive to provide intervention or have to do a lot more documentation, I would imagine.
It's an excellent point. I think the law will be very confusing to people about exactly who might be committing a felony and when from a provider perspective. So even though helping someone manage a miscarriage would not at all be going against the potential abortion ban that would be put in place in Wisconsin and elsewhere, physicians may absolutely be concerned about that and be hesitant to provide that care. So I think education is really important.
In our last moments together, how might this ban inform the research you do going forward?
We are trying as a research organization to think about how we document the impacts of this ban on people in our state and elsewhere. So it's absolutely certain that the number of abortions in Wisconsin will decrease dramatically, if not stop altogether. So while we want to track those numbers and track the numbers of people in our state who cross state lines to get their services, we also are looking to recruit Wisconsinites into studies where we could follow them over time about what their experiences are if they were either able to obtain desired abortions or if they weren't, and what happens to the latter group as a result, and what happens to the latter group's children and families as a result.
Jenny, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate, again, your attention to this issue. Thanks so much.
Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, directs the OBGYN Division of Reproductive and Population Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.